This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with A Doctor Delivers Podcast, and today I am discussing screening for fetal chromosomal differences as well as ultrasound for soft markers with genetic counselor Liz Sheehan. Have a listen. Today I'm joined by genetic counselor Liz Sheehan. You are at UPMC in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we connected over a mutual love and passion for educating on NTHFR gene mutations. And it's our friendship has blossomed from there. But we're here today because we want to talk about antenatal screening for fetal chromosomal abnormalities and why it's timely. And it's important for a couple of reasons. Given what's going on with access to reproductive choices, namely abortion, and the different states and the potential for severe restriction and possibly even no longer having access, understanding antenatal screening is extremely important, more so now than ever before. I mean, it's always important in my book, but I really think it's important now to understand what your options are and why antenatal screening for fetal chromosomal abnormalities is so important. And then the other reason is this, as someone who is, and I'm sure you would agree, as someone who is doing the ultrasounds at all gestational ages, but let's talk about the anatomy scan at 18 to 22 weeks. If I see something on ultrasound and a patient had declined antenatal screening for whatever reason, and the most common reason I get is, well, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to do anything about it. The purpose of antenatal screening is not because you would terminate a pregnancy if it was abnormal. That's probably the least reason I think that most people would do it. Would you agree? It's to have that information, right? So if you do see something on ultrasound, it's so much easier to counsel when we have that piece of information in front of us about what the actual risk is. And more often than not, it actually makes things a little bit better.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misinformation about your chromosome and conditions out there. The New York Times have had a couple of articles about it lately of patient experiences. So I think there's misinformation, not only on patient side, but on the provider side, as well as what they mean. I think importantly, what they do not mean, that none of these things that we talk about today are a diagnosis. But it is just about what information is actually helpful for you during a pregnancy. Nothing is mandatory during a pregnancy. You are well within your rights to decline whatever you feel like you would not find useful. But I think you need to go into it with the information and what we can actually do with some of this information. And that you're right, not all of this is used just for the purposes of ending an effective pregnancy, or that you wouldn't love a pregnancy any less because of what we find. It's more of what can we do to best take care of that pregnancy with some of this in our back pocket.
And so especially true if we see a fetal abnormality, like a heart defect or something else. Having a heart defect, and just as an example, and knowing that the genetics are normal helps. Also knowing that the genetics are not normal helps. So it's important for the neonatologist to know these things. And unfortunately, a lot of times what happens is they get too far out and they may not have access to the NIPT, which we're getting ready to discuss, and they can't go back and get that antenatal screening. So that's why I feel, of course, I'm biased because I am the one that's counseling a lot, and so are you. It's so important to really consider having the antenatal screening. So the first question I have for you, okay, we talk about genetics in a bunch of different words or terms that people may not understand. We commonly use aneuploidy, but let's talk about what exactly is an aneuploidy, and then what are some of the other things that we might, or that the people that are listening might understand it to be, like a chromosomal defect.
As a genetic counselor, it's my job to kind of explain this in plain language to people. So our chromosomes are strings of genetic information in all the cells of our body. It's how our most basic genetic information is organized. Now, we usually have 46 of them, and they all come in pairs because we get one from each parent. That's how we get our mix of genetic information at the point of conception. Pairs 1 through 22 are just named their number, and they're going to be the same amongst most people. And then our 23rd pair, what we call our sex chromosomes, where most people assigned female at birth have two X's. Most people assigned male at birth have an X and a Y. So when we talk about aneuploidies, that's a fancy name for a different number of chromosomes than we would expect for someone. There's either a hole missing or extra chromosome. And those most of the time are just things that happen by chance at the point of conception. And so, for example, people may know of Down syndrome, which is one of the things we're going to talk about today. And that's caused by just a whole extra copy of chromosome 21 in 95% of patients with that condition. Because they're things that just happen by chance in every pregnancy, everyone has a small chance to have a pregnancy affected with those conditions, regardless of your family history. I think that's another misconception. People decline these because they don't have family histories of conditions. And most of the time, we don't have family histories of these. They're just things that happen by chance. And so that's why we offer and talk about some of these screens to look for things that can just happen without any influence of the parents or the family.
Right, right. And so another thing that may be called chromosomal defect. What are some of the other things? Because I don't use aneuploidy a whole lot because that's when I'm talking to a patient, because most patients don't understand or know that term. Anything else that commonly used?
I like to refer to chromosome difference just because a defect or chromosome difference, negative connotation defect, to it. Yeah. And not everyone has a negative feeling towards children with these chromosome differences. So that's the term I like to use.
Chromosomal difference. That's great. I have not used that, and I will, because that absolutely makes sense. Okay. So what types of things would increase the risk of having a chromosomal difference?
So most of the time, what impacts our risk is actually age of the egg for the pregnancy. So the pregnant person, if they get pregnant through natural conception, their age, or if you're using an egg donor, the age of the egg at the time that it was retrieved. So age plays a factor, because most people have their eggs within them since the time that they were growing within their own parents. But those eggs don't make one last copy of themselves. So their own chromosomes don't split off to make sure they only give one to each egg. They're going to get the other one from the sperm until right before we get pregnant. And so the longer they've been sitting within someone, sometimes those chromosomes don't want to split off properly and they can get stuck together. And that can lead to a chromosome difference. So I think a lot of people understand or have heard of before that, you know, if you're over the age of 35, you have an increased chance to have a child affected with a chromosome difference. It's not that 35 is a magical number where all of a sudden you have a risk. We all have a risk from the time that we start our periods until the time that we stop having those periods. That risk just steadily increases year by year as people get older. And 35 is usually the point where that risk for all chromosome differences starts to approach around 1% for someone. So even increased chance, I think, of what we think of it in colloquial English language is not the same as what we think of increased chance with genetics. Increased chance is still about 1% at that 35-year mark.
Right. So
were you going to say, go ahead.
Yeah. So somebody had asked or commented, we're seeing a lot more Down syndrome cases and patients that are younger than 35. Is that because it's happening more often, or are people just talking about it more? Actually, most Down syndrome babies are born to those under age 35, because those are the patients that are having more babies. So of course you're going to have more Down syndrome cases and patients that are younger. It's probably true that they're talking about it more on social media and other outlets. But I don't know, I have not read of any increased incidence of that in that population. It's probably been the same, I would imagine. It's just that we're probably hearing about it more. But compared to less people having babies over age 35 and especially over age 40, the risk is higher for the reasons Liz just mentioned. But it's still overall, the numbers of babies, because we're having less babies in that age group with Down syndrome, or less Down syndrome babies are born in that patient population.
Yes, exactly.
So does that sound about right?
Anyone under 35, so that's from the time of about, 13, 14, when most people have already started their periods until 35, is a much bigger group than 35 to about mid-40s, which is when we start to even try to conceive. Yeah. You're going to have a much higher population of babies in general. So you're going to have a higher population of babies born with chromosome differences. But if you actually look at the rates of those, they're a lot lower than the rates of those in that smaller population after the age of 30.
Right. Okay. So what types of screening tests for chromosomal differences are available in pregnancy?
So there's a couple of different types. So we're focused on screening today. There are diagnostic tests that we'll talk about at another period of time that would tell us 100% yes or no. But as far as screening goes, there's screening through ultrasound that tell us, are there features of these types of conditions that we'd expect to see a little more frequently? And then there are blood screens that tell us, are there markers or amounts of genetic information different from what we'd expect. But none of these things tell us 100% yes or no. And that's what we want to hit home today, guys, and that what these results mean and not mean, but you're never going to get a diagnosis from these things.
Yeah, and we're going to talk next about cell-free cell-free DNA screening. I want to talk about that first because it's being done a lot more. And people often think that it's diagnostic. It is not diagnostic. It is still a screening test, although it performs better for certain chromosomal differences than, like, say, the quad screen, and we'll talk about that. It is still a screening test. So definitive decisions about a pregnancy one way or the other should not be made based on a self-free DNA screening test.
Yes.
It is still a screening test. So talk about the self-free DNA screening test. Like, what exactly is it? How is the test done? Where are they getting that? It used to be called cell-free fetal DNA, but NIPT is Panorama, some of the other tests, there's so many different names, but they basically they're all cell-free DNA from the fetus. How do they do that test?
So like, where does it's a blood test, so it's not a risk to the pregnancy at all to do that kind of testing. And it's used to be called cell-free fetal DNA, but it's not actually directly from the fetus itself. Our interface with the pregnancy is actually through that placenta. And so cells at the edge of the placenta that then go into our uterus and then through our own bloodstream are shedding off from there. So that DNA that's broken up in the blood that we get from the pregnancy is actually stemming from the placenta. So normally we all have free-flowing genetic information, little bits of chromosomes floating in all of our blood. And when someone's pregnant, they're going to have a little bit of that as well coming from the placenta. It's what they calculate as the fetal fraction or the amount that they consider to be coming from the pregnancy itself. And so able to measure that to see how much they'd expect to see from you in pregnancy at that point in pregnancy and how much they're actually seeing. And if there's a difference there, it's pretty unlikely to be coming from the patient themselves. And so that increases the chance that there's a difference coming from the placenta and therefore increases the chance that there's a difference within the baby. And that's how they screen for some of the more common chromosome differences that can continue through pregnancy and have babies be born with those conditions.
Yeah, someone had asked me before on another topic, how is it that if the fetal DNA or fetus, now we know it's not actually from the body of the fetus, it's from the actually trophoblast layer of the placenta is where that DNA comes from and enters the maternal circulation. How are the pregnant individuals not recognizing it as foreign and launching an attack? Like when we think about, say, red blood cell alloimmunization or Rh negative, situations. It's different because with Rh negative, you're getting a whole red blood cell exchange between with the antigens on the actual surface of the red blood cell that the maternal circulation gets access to for whatever reason. And then that's when the antibodies are formed against those fetal antigens on those red blood cells. So it's not just DNA circulating. That's a totally different, pathophysiology of the disease process with like Rh disease than with what we're talking about here. So
the maternal circulation, genetic information. Yeah. They're not Go whole ahead. Cells or foreign bodies.
Right. Okay. And so in the cell-free DNA screening typically looks for trisomies 18, 13, 21, correct. And then the sex chromosomes, correct? And trisomy 21 is Down syndrome. Trisomy 18 is called, it's the Patel, right?
Or am I mixing up? I always get those mixed up.
So trisomy 18 is Edwards, trisomy 13 is Patel. This has been a struggle with me for 20 years. I always get those two mixed up. Okay. And that's the other thing is I always think about numbers rather than the actual name. So that's another reason why. Okay. So when can this test be done?
I would say most of the time we don't actually use Edwards and Patel so much anymore. 13.
Yeah. Okay. So when in pregnancy can the cell-free DNA screening be done?
So there are some labs that say it can be done as early as 9 or 10 weeks in pregnancy. We as an institution recommend doing it after 11 weeks in pregnancy, just because you need that time for that DNA from the pregnancy to build up in your blood for us to actually get a reportable result. The earlier in pregnancy you do it and early on in the trimester, the less likely you're going to have an informative result. And there's a lot of things like the weight of the patient, influencing the blood volume that someone has, if people are on blood thinners for whatever reason, things that would just limit the amount of DNA per sample, that we just generally get the most success after 11 weeks in pregnancy doing this. But it can be done anytime after 11 weeks in pregnancy.
Yeah, and I know a lot of institutions will do 10 weeks, but I do think that we see a lot more no-call results, and we'll talk about that earlier on, that we do it. I do not agree with it being done before 10 weeks, and I know a lot of providers will do that. I think the potential of having a no-call result is too much, and too much could cause too much stress, that I would never offer it before 10 weeks. 2 weeks is the earliest I would offer it, but I do know that—
We don't offer it any earlier than that.
What's that? How accurate is
accuracy always depend on what your chance was before the test to have that pregnancy affected. I think people incorrectly, and physicians as well, conflate detection rates with accuracy. Those are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody from this test should ever be telling you you have a 99% chance to have a child affected without telling you that they did some math to get to that number first. So detection rates of how many pregnancies this can detect that would be affected with the condition, usually for Down syndrome, are around 99%. So that's sometimes where they get that number from. So if there's 100 pregnancies affected with Down syndrome, about 99 of them would flag positive on this type of screening. For trisomy 18, usually metadata tells us it's about 97% or 98%. For trisomy 13, it's a little more wishy-washy, but can be up to 99% as well. And so when we find that there is a positive result, we do some math to calculate what we call the positive predictive value. And this is the actual chance babies affected with that condition. And that's always going to depend on what your chance was before the test to begin with. And that's where someone's age-related risk can be a factor of what the chance was based on age. If there are ultrasound findings, which we'll talk about here in a little bit, or any other prior screening tests that maybe weren't quite as high of a detection rate as with NIPT. So we always start with that number first and calculate how sensitive the test is for that. And that's where we get a number. So most people over the age of 35 are probably getting an accuracy or positive predictive value for baby to actually be affected in the realm of about 80 to 90% for Down syndrome. That number is a lot lower for conditions like trisomies 18 or 13, because there's a higher chance of what we call confined placental mosaicism, or differences just in the placenta that aren't necessarily in the fetus. And so those chances that babies affected are going to be lower at 50, 40, 30%, depending on what the chance was to begin with before.
Okay. Now, we've already talked about what traditionally the cell-free DNA screening is looking for: trisomies 21, 18, 13, sex chromosomes. But there's other things that the test is starting to look for, but it's not really being offered at all places because it's not been validated or has not been shown to consistently perform. Those things would be like what I came up with was triploidy, microdeletions, large deletions. So when would we potentially use, or can we use, cell-free DNA to detect other things besides those trisomies?
I think those can be helpful in cases where you have a pretty strong clinical suspicion for some of those. So there's findings on ultrasound that make you think of some of those conditions. Triploidy is a condition where there's three copies of every single chromosome. Most of the time, that's one egg that's been fertilized by two sperm. And that's also something that can happen. It can be a pretty common cause of early first trimester miscarriages. But occasionally, it can go through the first trimester and well into the second trimester, and usually presents as really tiny, tiny fetuses or underdeveloped fetuses, really abnormal placentas. And so if a patient really isn't feeling like a diagnostic test is something that they'd want to go through, sometimes they can consider screening through NIPT for triploidy. However, you need a very specific form of NIPT to be able to do that. There are two different platforms or types of NIPT. There's one through NGS, which is just sequencing, and there's one that uses SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms, to see how much of that information is there. And only a SNP-based platform can detect triploidy. Those other things you mentioned, those are called mm-hmm. microdeletion syndromes. And so those are smaller pieces missing in the chromosome that aren't whole missing chromosomes, but maybe have then just a smaller chunk that wasn't included. And those can be pretty hit or miss because they can be pretty variable from person to person. That being said, that means sometimes they can be inherited from an affected parent. And so if the pregnant patient themselves has a microdeletion syndrome, that part of the test is null and void to be able to determine if the fetus would be affected with that. Mm-hmm. Same with sex chromosome differences. If a parent themselves has a sex chromosome difference, you are not going to be able to tell if that fetus has a sex chromosome difference.
Right. Okay. So what it's being used for and what it's most accurate in is performing the best for are for trisomies 21, 18, and 13 and the sex chromosomes. There's another indication to do it. Again, not all places will offer that for the things that we just mentioned, like triploidy, microdeletions, large deletions. But I would think that if that is suspected based on fetal ultrasound findings or there's a history of it, the best way to rule that in or out would be with the diagnostic test like a CVS or an amniocentesis. That's the best way to know for sure because these screening tests we had just don't perform as well for those yet. Hopefully sometime down the road they will. But I know we typically, if we're suspicious of those things that aren't the typical trisomies, we will recommend diagnostic testing. Does that sound about right? Yeah. Okay. Now, let's talk about the fetal fraction for cell-free DNA, because everybody talks about that. What does it mean, the fetal fraction, and what can affect
the fetal fraction? So that's the amount of DNA that they estimate is coming from the pregnancy itself and not necessarily from the pregnant patient. And there are lots of things that can impact it. Earlier in gestation, sometimes pregnancies don't just put out as much DNA and there's no real reason for it. If the placenta isn't developing as well as we would expect and there are placental problems, then that can certainly impact it. One of the biggest impacts that we have is weight of the pregnant person, because as our weight increases, mm-hmm. our blood volume has to increase to accommodate for that extra space. Mm-hmm. And so the more of a blood volume you have, the more dilute your genetic information going to be in each draw you take from that. And so that can certainly be a contributing factor. If you're on blood thinners, the same concept applies where you're going to have a more dilute sample of that DNA per blood test.
Okay, so then what the fetal fraction we want
is usually anything about 4% we can pretty reliably do NIPT on. There are some labs that say that can do it anywhere above 2-3%, but that's not going to be consistent across all laboratories.
Right. Okay. So what does it mean if someone gets the NIPT or cell-free DNA screening test and it comes back as a no-call result? Or this is something about low
fetal fraction. So that just means there was not enough of the DNA that they attribute from the pregnancy to be able to accurately measure what's a typical result versus an atypical result.
And the things that you just mentioned can cause a no-call result to occur. But so what do we do in that situation if a patient had the cell-free DNA screening test and it came back as a low fetal fraction, or it can come back as either low fetal fraction or a no call.
So it depends on the laboratory. Usually they'll make a note on there as to why there was a no call. The vast majority of time it's because of low fetal fraction. Other times it could be quality control issues with the sample that has nothing to do with the fetal fraction. But if you have a low fetal fraction result, then we would talk about kind of possibilities for explanations of why it may be a low risk result. Certainly, if there doesn't seem to be any other explanation for why that's the case, more severe chromosome differences like a trisomy 18 or 13 or even a triploidy, things that can also impact the placenta and how well it functions, may be the cause of some of that. And so it's a discussion of, do we try that NIPT one more time now that you're a little further along than the first time to see if we can get an informative result? Or do we want to pursue an option of a diagnostic test depending on how far along you are? Mm-hmm.
Right. So what I've seen a few times, because we get a lot of referrals from outside providers, is they'll keep drawing it and keep drawing it. And the next thing you know, they've had it 3 times, 4 times. And in my opinion, and you can give your opinion, if we can't really find a reason, I would do it one more time, maybe wait a week or two. unless there's something else going on with the pregnancy that we see on ultrasound that is indicating that there could be an aneuploidy or chromosomal difference. And you may not want to wait that extra how many ever days it takes to get an NIPT and discuss, just go ahead and getting a diagnostic test. So it obviously would depend on when you're getting those results. But I wouldn't keep doing it over and over again in the hopes that you're going to get a result. But overall, most of the time when they do a second test, you can get a result up into, I think it's like 75% of cases.
Depends on why in the first place.
Right.
Also cap it at 2 times. We don't offer it any more than just one other reason.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, I've seen that a lot more from some of the outlying providers that are doing it multiple times. And what it only, all that it does is delay getting a more accurate diagnosis. So, I think repeating it one time would be okay, unless I see something on ultrasound where I think that it might be best to not delay and go ahead and offer the, talk about doing the diagnostic testing like a CBS or amniocentesis. Okay. Why is it important to have accurate pregnancy dating? And, so let's talk about pregnancy dating. There's been studies that have shown that up to 3/4 of pregnancy of patients, even when they're 100% sure the first day of the last menstrual period, they are not correct. I change due dates with these early ultrasounds more than I don't, actually. So, and it's not any disrespect to the individual. It's just, it's hard. I mean, we don't always think about it, and we might have written it down or skipped a month or, didn't, recall, or it might have been a shorter period and we didn't really realize. So having early pregnancy dating by ultrasound is ideal for everyone to get accurate dating. So why is it important, if we can, to have that accurate dating, preferably by ultrasound, before we do the cell-free DNA
because it helps make sure doing it in the right time frame to be able to do this test. And contrary to popular belief, biology is not 100% foolproof. And so even if you know your LMP to the date, your body may not have implanted that embryo on the date that it would have expected to. You may not have gotten pregnant, have had a different ovulation window than you've expected to. Our bodies do weird things to us. So it's always helpful to have an early first trimester ultrasound before considering your screening or diagnostic testing options, just to make sure that we know what those options are and what those windows may look like.
Yeah, I love having first trimester dating. It's so, so important. And we're doing it a lot more now than we used to, because we're getting more information and we understand the value of it. So it's important that we go ahead, even if the patient says they know their LMP 100% sure. So what if it's twins and you didn't know when you got the cell-free DNA screening test and, and then you find out later. So that does affect things. So it's important to try to have that sonographic dating confirmation before we do this test. Are there any situations when we should not offer cell-free DNA screening?
If the patient themselves is affected earlier with a condition that you're concerned for on the NIPT, if there are definitive concerns for a specific condition that would not be included on NIPT, not all insurances are covering NIPT for everybody. I know we're a little bit behind the times here with one of our major payers in Pittsburgh. So it's only covering NIPT for someone at an increased risk. So over the age of 35, there's an abnormal ultrasound finding. One of your prior screens, which we'll talk about here in a second, was high risk. So there are a couple instances where it may not be the best test for you, but it's important to have that conversation with the provider to explain why that may be the case and what alternatives there may be.
Right. And then the other thing before we move on to the next type of screening, two things. Number one, if you do have the NIPT or cell-free DNA screening test, you do need to get the alpha fetoprotein measurement after 15 weeks. Why? Because elevated AFP could potentially indicate that there is an like a neural tube defect, encephaly, potentially a placental issue. So getting that after 15 weeks is still required. And also, if you are advanced maternal age and you do the cell-free DNA screening test, more and more of us are offering the NT screening, the nuchal translucency screening along with that, because of the increased risk of having defects in the fetus, like birth defects in the fetus in that age group as well. So if over age 35 and you're getting the cell-free DNA screening test, talk to your provider about getting that, just that NT measurement, not the whole thing, not the blood test plus the NT. You don't need to repeat double dip in the blood test screening you know, you just get that NT measurement if over age 35, and especially over age 40. So that's important to know about the cell-free DNA screening test.
There have been a couple people asking about PGT-A and using NIPT after that. We do not have all the time in the world to talk about PGT-A, but I do counsel on it regularly. PGT-A is also a screening test that to figure out if embryos are going to be more or less likely to be affected with chromosome differences. It still takes from that trophectoderm, that area that's going to become the placenta for the pregnancy. So actually following that up with NIPT doesn't really add any additional information because it's still just getting placental information. It doesn't hurt if you want to do it, but the only way you're going to find out more specific information about whether that really is a low risk PGT-A result from a successful implantation is through ultrasounds as well as amniocentesis after 16 weeks in pregnancy. Certainly, we can go through a whole other live about PGT-A and IVF screenings, but generally not recommended.
Yeah, so it's still, so we still, the ASRM and ACOG and all them still recommend that we offer antenatal screening to those with PGT-A tested embryos.
But it's a conversation so, you know, of what kind of antenatal screening is actually at the patient you have.
Right. Right. So you got to discuss which type of antenatal screening is best depending on your specific situation. But I do know a lot of patients who understand that and will opt for the, especially the older age group, will opt for the diagnostic testing, even in PGT-A tested embryos. So bottom line is PGT-A tested embryos does not remove your risk of having a chromosomally different fetus. So you still need to discuss which type of antenatal screening is better for you and whether or not you want to do an amniocentesis. So that's still be a discussion. Okay.
Your chance though, from yes. If you weren't to have done PGT-A in the first place.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So a first trimester screening. So the other thing about the cell-free DNA real quick is that you can do it from 10 weeks, 11 weeks on. You can do it at any time in the pregnancy. So that's important to remember. Now, first trimester screening is first trimester screening. What people most often will think about is the NT screening with the serum, what we call serum analytes. So explain what
that's looking at does. Specifically a protein and a hormone made by the pregnancy. So every pregnant person should have this, these levels of hormones in your blood and the first trimester. The first is a hormone called HCG. That's usually the hormone that tells us if we're pregnant or not. And then the second is a placental protein called PAPA. And they look for patterns of how much they expect to see those levels versus what they're actually seeing. See, are they seeing a pattern they see a little more frequently in babies with two chromosome differences, Down syndrome and trisomy 18. In addition with a nuchal translucency measurement, that ultrasound that Dr. Clark was talking about earlier, as well as your age-related risk. And it comes up with a one in something chance for baby to be affected with one of those two conditions.
Right, so basically all fetuses have a little bit of fluid in the skin behind the neck. All of them do, but it's when it gets beyond a certain measurement that becomes concerning. So you put in that measurement along with the blood test, typically done on the same day if possible, or then I don't know what the time period is, but you should do it on the same day of the NT screening, send them straight for the blood test. And then that will give you a risk for trisomy 21 and trisomy 18. What about, does it look at the-
No, it does not. AFP, so you still need to do a second trimester type of screening for that with AFP to be able to look for open neural tube differences.
Okay. So with enlarged, what we call an enlarged nuchal translucency or NT would be anything 3 millimeters or more, which is typically associated with a concern that there could be a chromosomal difference or other types of birth defects that can be seen later on in the pregnancy. Okay. So a lot of my patients actually get this type of screening, the blood test plus the NT measurement. Okay. And then second trimester screening, we think about quad screen is the most common second trimester screen that's typically done, depending on the lab, after 15 weeks and up to 22 weeks, 6 days. But it also depends on the lab because some are cut off at 20 weeks, some 21. It all is laboratory dependent. So what
those are
we looking at with
four proteins and hormones. So there's HCG, inhibin A, unconjugated estriol, and AFP. And again, similar to the first trimester screen, it's looking for patterns that they see a little more frequently in babies with, again, Down syndrome or trisomy 18. Mm-hmm. But then because you're looking at AFP, it is screening for those open neural tube differences. Quad screen and first trimester screen don't have as high detection rates as something like NIPT. So on average, first trimester screening has a detection rate of about 85% for Down syndrome and trisomy 18. For quad screen, it can dip around 70% for Down syndrome, maybe about 60% for trisomy 18. But again, thinking of people at average risk under the age of 35, so your age-related risk is going to be lower anyway, it's still detecting a vast majority of those pregnancies that would be affected.
Yeah, so that's typically going to be done if someone presents or doesn't get, you know, to care or for whatever reason until after 15 weeks. What I'm seeing is most people are getting, like I said, the NIPT earlier on in pregnancy, but we still, based on patients that are referred in, still have a fairly large number that are getting quad screens. So there still is some benefit to that. But, you know, you still need to ask about what your options are for antenatal screening based on your gestational age. Also, just touch on really quickly about the penta screen and the triple screen. I've never used those in any institution I've ever been at. Is that something that's typically done? I know they're just looking at different the different hormone levels, but
yeah, they're not done as commonly. Right? I think the triple screen, I'm not quite as familiar with. The penta screen, some providers around here do order it every once in a while. It's just looking for a different form of HCG. And there's not really a ton of significant data to suggest it increases the sensitivity of the testing or the detection rates of it. I think a lot of it is just marketing from a laboratory to say they look for more.
Yeah. Okay. So here's a good question. And I see this too, is double dipping or just throwing all the different screening tests at a patient. NIPT, then plus an NT or the NT plus the serum screening, and then adding on a quad. Why
I think we have to think carefully about what information is actually adding to our knowledge base. So traditionally, when we only had first trimester screen and quad screening, it was not recommended to follow up a screening test with another screening test. And that's because if you were to do that, first trimester screen has a higher detection rate than quad screening does. And so why would you follow up a high risk first trimester screen with a quad screen when it has a lower detection rate for those things? If you get conflicting information, how do you reconcile those two different things? And so now that we have NIPT available, we are getting some people who follow up with the screening test, but you're following it up with a better screening test, one with a higher detection rate. And now that your chance to have a pregnancy affected is higher from maybe a first trimester screen or a quad screen than your age-related risk would have been, again, figuring out what that positive predictive value or if a negative, that residual risk would be is a lot easier to do because we have a more specific number to your pregnancy. And so you're having a higher detection rate after first trimester screen or quad screen, which is not something that was available 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. So that's another little pet peeve of mine. When patients come in because they have had two or sometimes three screening tests, one showed a high risk and they're thinking, well, the other two cancel it out. Well, that's not necessarily true. And, you know, sometimes I can't tell them anything. I tend to fall back on if that first earlier screening test, like the NIPT or first trimester screening was positive, that holds a lot more weight than anything done after that. But, you know, what I've seen a couple of times is the first trimester screening was negative, and then for whatever reason, they got a quad screen and that comes back in normal. Then you're really in a pickle. So, you know, don't double dip in the screening test. More is not better in the situation. The earlier you can get some screening is the best, is whether it's for the NIPT screen or earlier in pregnancy or the first trimester screening with the NT measurement plus the serum analytes is what we call them. Those are my two preferred. If I can have that, I'm totally happy. So that's what my recommendation would be.
Yeah, so you
would that
just
be want
to go
well?
Up in detection rate. So even if you have a screen, you're not ready to commit to a diagnostic test, then probably an NIPT would be another good option for you. If you have NIPT, there's nothing else that's going to give us a higher detection rate than that in screening. So then it's a conversation of, do you want to confirm that with a diagnostic test or not?
Right. You know, according to ACOG, everyone is entitled to have antenatal screening and a diagnostic test if they choose it. Now, I know some insurance companies are not necessarily on board, which really stinks. And you might have to get pre-approval or whatever. But if you're in that boat, you know, wherever you're getting your ultrasound or your testing from can work that out, help work that out for you, and give them the reasons why certain things are done. I think by and large, most providers or insurance carriers are on board, even Medicaid. Mm-hmm. I have less problem with Medicaid, actually, because most of my patients are on Medicaid than I do with some of the private payers in these situations. So, you know, it's everyone is entitled to some form of antenatal screening and even diagnostic testing if they choose, 100%. Even in the absence of any findings. Okay, so we're not going to be able to spend a whole lot of time because we've talked a lot about the screening test, but I wanted to talk about soft markers. And I'm going to give what my little talk is when I'm trying to explain, and then you can piggyback on that as the genetic counselor. So, you know, as a maternal fetal medicine specialist, I'm doing the detailed ultrasounds and even earlier, hopefully have the antenatal screening on board and have that testing available. And then we look for two types of abnormalities or what we call defects or markers in a fetus. The first one would be a major defect. That would be a birth defect that does require management post-delivery, like a hole in the heart, something, a brain defect or cleft lip, cleft palate, something that is going to alter the management of the baby once it's born. Some defects are more severe or significant than others. Not all of them are significant. And then you look at something called soft markers or minor markers. I call them minor markers and major defects, but they could be called soft markers as well. These things are not birth defects. They do not affect the baby. They don't have to be addressed after the baby is born. But when we see them, especially more than one, or if we see one and we don't have the antenatal screening, then it might alter how we counsel you about the risk of the fetus having a chromosomal difference. So, for example, what we're going to talk about real quickly is choroid plexus cyst, echogenic intracardiac focus, the echogenic bowel, and there was another one, pyelectasis and single umbilical artery are the five most common, but you could look at short humerus and short femur as well. But those are the most common ones that are considered soft markers. And what's most important is once you see that, or we see that, if you're not already there for a detailed ultrasound, then you will get upgraded to a detailed ultrasound to look at more of the anatomy of the baby. Say you were low risk otherwise, you came in for just a basic routine anatomy scan, your antenatal screening was negative or low risk, you get the ultrasound and now you see a choroid plexus cyst. A lot of these, if you have negative screening, there's nothing else to do. We don't have to offer any additional testing. If you don't have the screening, then we need to talk to you about additional testing, whether it be doing the antenatal screening because you're in that window, or diagnostic testing or something different depending on what we see. But again, these are soft markers. So whether or not you have the antenatal screening test coming into that ultrasound will affect how you're gonna get counseled. But just to reiterate, none of these things are birth defects that we see, well, like soft markers.
Yeah, is there anything you would add to that? They also don't diagnose baby with any of these conditions. So
We see soft markers a lot, ultrasound. Actually. We do.
Mm-hmm. And there are what mm-hmm. we call likelihood ratios usually attached to them. So it's how likely a pregnancy is, or how much it increases someone's chance to be affected with a specific condition when we see them. So when we see them, that allows us to do more math to figure out what your chances to have a child with that condition. And that can be based on prior screening, like Dr. Clark had said, or just based on age-related risk if you haven't had any prior screening. And so when you hear about these things from your doctor, always ask about how does this change my risk for pregnancy? But no provider should ever be telling you, oh, your baby definitely has this particular condition based on what these soft findings are on ultrasound.
Okay. So I'm just going to go through real quick. And then I'm going to give a little bit about what we would do. And you add on anything if you want to add on anything. Let's talk about first about choroid plexus cyst. If you've had negative antenatal screening, no additional testing is recommended. Mm-hmm. And this is assuming this is all we see. Okay. This is assuming this, we're seeing what we call an isolated soft marker. Okay. When you start to see more than one, that will change things a little bit as far as your counseling and what's going to be offered to you. But if we're seeing an isolated choroid plexus cyst or cyst, it doesn't matter which one, you know, whether it's one or a few. As long as the screening is negative, that you had, then there's no other indication for further workup for chromosomal differences. If you don't have any previous screening, then we're going to counsel you about the potential for trisomy 18, which is one of the things that you could see our choroplex assist in those babies that have trisomy 18. And then you will be offered screening, or depending how far along you are, what else we see. If we see anything else, more significant than the choroplex assist, then you might be offered a diagnostic test. Does that sound about right?
Choroplex assist, they're not going to hurt the baby's brain. It's not cysts like we would normally think of cysts, outside that they're pus-filled and stuff like that. Most of the time they go away later in pregnancy. Even if they don't, they're not impacting the brain whatsoever. So it sounds scary to have a cyst on the brain, but it's really not a scary thing, I promise. By themselves, they can be pretty common. They are seen very commonly in babies with trisomy 18, but the reverse is not true when we don't see any other features associated. And that is a condition where we'd expect to see pretty significant findings on an ultrasound, other severe birth differences, or more closer associated findings on ultrasound than just an isolated choroid plexus cyst.
Good, good. Okay, echogenic intracardiac focus. That is a bright area in one of the chambers, or more than one chamber of the heart, on the muscles that are within that chamber. Same thing applies. If you have antenatal screening and you have the isolated echogenic intracardiac focus, no other testing is needed. If you don't have prior antenatal screening and we see that isolated, then we are going to offer some kind of antenatal screening. Most often, you know, it would either be a quad screen, or if you're in that window, or the cell-free DNA screening test, because again, the anatomy scan is typically done at 18 to 22 weeks. So that, and again, it's not a birth defect. It doesn't cause, it's not a heart defect or anything like that. And it doesn't matter. None of these things matter if they are not seen later on. It matters when you see them in that window. So a lot of people say, well, will it go away? Well, a lot of times they do go away, but it still doesn't mean that I'm changing how I'm counseling you,
right?
Because I see it now.
No, it won't even impact heart function later on in life. They're not going to have heart attacks because of it. And again, by themselves, they truly mean nothing. They're just normal variations. We see them pretty commonly on ultrasound.
Right. Echogenic bowel is another thing. Although it is associated with aneuploidy or chromosomal differences, it can be associated with cystic fibrosis, congenital viral infections, if there's something going on within the gastrointestinal tract, and also can lead to fetal growth restrictions. So this one is a little bit more complex. So we, you know, if you've had negative screening, antenatal screening, then that pretty much tells us it's probably not from an aneuploidy, or we don't have to worry as much about aneuploidy, but we still need to talk to you about those other things that could be associated with echogenic bowel. So if you are, you know, obviously if somebody in your family or you are a carrier for cystic fibrosis and then your fetus has echogenic bowel, then obviously that's going to be ringing bells for us. That's what we, you know, we have to worry about. So the recommendation is, if you've had a negative screening, then you don't need any further workup for aneuploidy or chromosomal differences. But you still need to have the conversation about cystic fibrosis, and if there's any potential for fetal or viral infection exposure, like cytomegalovirus would be one. So we would look at other markers for that as well. And then we also typically recommend just another growth ultrasound in the third trimester, just to see how the baby's growing. But you know, and if you don't have the screening, we'll obviously recommend that antenatal screening to you. Anything else you want to add for the...
The vast majority of these are also still normal variants. About 85% of babies with an echogenic bowel do not have any of these conditions. We offer scans at that follow-up to also assess the bowel to see if there's any bulging of the bowel that may indicate there could be a narrowing or a blockage somewhere within there, more than just looking at the growth. But most of the time, again, it goes away. It's not of consequence to baby, but it is a more evolved discussion. And so your OBGYN may refer you to an MFM center or a genetic counselor to have that discussion with you, because there's more than just kind of one particular condition it can increase chances for.
Okay. And then pyelectasis, that's a renal marker for fetuses. It's actually more common in male babies or those with XY chromosomes. Basically, same thing. If you've had antenatal screening and you have isolated pyelectasis, there's no indication to do a further aneuploidy or chromosomal difference workup. However, we would need to follow you for a couple more time points in the pregnancy to look at that measurement again, because most of them will... turn to normal. But if they start to increase in the measurement or go into something like hydronephrosis, then that's something that needs to be looked at in the baby once it's born. So that's important. We don't just let it go. We will follow you depending on what that measurement is at certain time points in the pregnancy for a follow-up ultrasound. If you don't have the screening test, then we're going to obviously recommend that you get it. And so that we can look and make sure there's no increased risk for aneuploidy. Anything to add to pilosis?
Off marker for Down syndrome. It barely increases the risk for Down syndrome. So if, again, if it's by itself, probably doesn't mean it, but consider screening if you haven't had any.
Right, right. And then last one I want to talk about is single umbilical artery. I just picked these five because these are the ones that we see the most and that I counsel about the most. So the normal umbilical cord or typical umbilical cord during pregnancy has two arteries and one vein. And some fetuses, they have one artery and one vein. So same thing. If you had antenatal screening before and it's negative, nothing else to do to check for aneuploidy. Obviously, if you see other abnormalities, and again, all these things, when we see them, we're going to be upgrading you to a detailed ultrasound if you're not already there for an ultrasound. A detailed ultrasound. So if you don't have the screening, we're going to recommend that you get the screening. The other thing is single umbilical arteries, different institutions will have different policies. Some will follow with routine growth scans, and then some will just do another one in the third trimester. There's really no right or wrong answer. I don't see a lot of growth restriction cases in my, you know, in my years of practice with single umbilical artery, although it could happen. So we, depending on anything else that's going on, will like if there's diabetes or hypertension, we'll do serial, or we will just bring them back if nothing else is going on in the third trimester for a growth evaluation. This has nothing to do, people confuse it a lot, with the insertion of the cord, umbilical cord into the placenta. That's a different thing, okay? This is just the number of vessels within the umbilical cord. Instead of two arteries and one vein, you have one artery, one vein, okay?
No, anything again, to add to by itself, it's usually just normal finding. It can be very common in some pregnancies, especially in twins. So it's always depending on what we additionally see on ultrasound.
Right. So that goes over the basics of the soft markers. I hope that helps because I know patients are terrified and I understand because they don't understand, you know, I can explain it just like this and then they'll go and they'll start getting on Google and they'll freak themselves out even more. But really, when you have the antenatal screening on board, you get that ultrasound at 18 to 22 weeks. If this is isolated findings with these soft markers, they're more often than not lead to nothing else. But, you know, depending on, like the echogenic bowel is probably the one that's a little bit more complex than the other ones because you have to think about a few other things. But more often than not, it's just fine. And then the pilosis one, you need to evaluate later on in the pregnancy. But other than that, again, another reason why, this is probably my biggest argument actually for getting the antenatal screening is it's so much easier to counsel a patient that has that when I see these soft markers. And it's so much less scary for them too, because I can actually give them the numbers and explain.
Yeah, 100%.
Does that make sense?
Someone had asked about a high risk screening, but a completely typical ultrasound. So ultrasound, just like those other screenings, are just screening. They're not going to diagnose baby with a chromosome difference, whether we find one of those things, or they're also going to eliminate the chance for a chromosome difference if we don't find any of those things. About half of babies with Down syndrome have some sort of finding, like we talked about on that ultrasound. And about 70 to 90% of babies with trisomies 18 or 13 can have some sort of finding. So while a negative level 2 detailed anatomy scan is very reassuring for us not to see any of those things, it reduces your chance by 50% for Down syndrome and 70 to 90% for trisomy 18. So again, it's about asking your provider of what your chances were before and how this ultrasound changes those chances. If your provider is not familiar with that, that's okay. Ask them to refer you to a genetic counselor. We know those things and we will talk about those things in detail with you. These are things Dr. Clark and I talk about on a daily basis with all of our patients. And so we're very familiar with doing all these different calculations specific to you, not what everyone else goes through. And I think that's one of the limitations of Google is that it gives the very best and the very worst of experience, not what most people tend to go through. And it sure is not going to be specific to yourself. And so I'll always ask for a referral to someone who knows a little more about these things and can walk through that risk with you.
Right. And then, you know, again, just like you said, ultrasound is even a screening test. Having a normal ultrasound in the presence of normal or even abnormal antenatal screening test does not tell you 100% for sure. The only way to do that is with diagnostic testing, which would be amniocentesis later in the pregnancy, or CVS, which is typically done earlier in the pregnancy. But you do not have to do that. There are risks associated with those procedures. So if that's something that you're interested in, usually the MFM and or the genetic counselor could talk to you about those risks. But it is, and again, and doing a diagnostic test does not mean that you are going to terminate the pregnancy if it comes back abnormal. What it does, what I find, is it gives the patient a peace of mind. Either way, actually, if there are findings and they have a diagnosis, then they can prepare better. If it comes back normal, then they can kind of breathe a sigh of relief for the remainder of their pregnancy. So that's, diagnostic testing does have its benefits and its positives in those in individuals in certain situations. I'm going to spend a few minutes answering questions. So this is an interesting one. I had an NIPT, ran at 12 and a half weeks. The sex chromosomes came back as no result. I'm getting an amnio to determine if there's something truly wrong. How common are false positives on the sex chromosomes?
Yes, I have.
I've actually never seen that. Have you?
Laboratory as to what it means, unfortunately. So without being your counselor and having your report in front of me, I don't know exactly what that means. For some laboratories, the sex chromosomes are harder to do with the X chromosome because mom gives so much of that X chromosome, right? And so if there's slight variations, they don't know what's attributed to just normal variation in blood versus if there is going to be a difference in the fetus. So sometimes labs will just say, well, there's a no report because we just can't figure it out. It's as if we just didn't do that part of the test. So it doesn't increase your chance, but it also doesn't decrease your chance. And other times laboratories may have comments. So if your provider or genetic counselor calls the laboratory to clarify, the laboratory has inside information that they can't put on the report that says, oh, we did see additional X chromosome material or additional Y chromosome material, but it didn't quite meet the threshold for a fully abnormal result. So there may be an increased risk for some of these, but it's not going to be the same as a completely high risk screen result for that condition. So definitely have your providers reach out to that laboratory or refer to a genetic counselor if they haven't already. And they can talk about that in more detail with you depending on what the laboratory is and what that result actually says. But sometimes it cannot be uncommon, especially if there's lower fetal fraction. So if it's in that 3-4% range and it's a lab that says they can do it less than 4%, we've seen that actually quite commonly.
Real quick about Down syndrome. This person was talking about in their Down syndrome group, many of us had no soft markers or any abnormalities in the measurements. So one of the reasons why we talk so much about Down syndrome, and that's kind of like the main, the main thing that we talk about when we talk about chromosomal differences is Down syndrome. And the reason for that is that Down syndrome, a lot of them on ultrasound don't have any abnormalities. So there's a larger percentage of those babies that don't have anything abnormal on ultrasound. So getting that antenatal screening is important. Whereas like trisomies 13 and 18, very rare. I don't know if I've ever seen a trisomy 18 or 13 baby that did not have at least one major defect. So you're typically going to see a lot of abnormalities in trisomies 18 and 13. Not so for Down syndrome. So that's why we put so much emphasis on Down syndrome when we're talking about chromosomal differences.
Yeah, I think.
Would you have anything to add to that?
Talk about it because it's the most common one to continue through pregnancy and have babies be born with that condition as well. Only about half of babies with Down syndrome have a heart defect, and like we said, only about half of babies with Down syndrome have any sort of finding, big or small, on that anatomy scan. And so those babies like to surprise us at birth a lot. If that parent is looking for more information before babies are born, that's where screening is available. There are certainly some parents who don't want to know that information ahead of time, and that's fine. But there are screens available because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this question is like, I think earlier in the discussion they just said, so this sounds like this discussion is about natural, quote unquote, natural pregnancies and not PGS testing with IVF. No, it's for both. Because even if you've had, like we said earlier, even if you've had PGS or PGT testing of the embryos, you still need to do some form of testing, whether it be screening or diagnostic testing in your pregnancy. For example, I had donor egg conceived twins. My donor was 23 or 24 at the time. Mm-hmm. I still did antenatal screening. I actually chose to do the serum screening with the NT measurements in that time window. for my when I was pregnant. But even though my donor was of a younger age and we still had PGT tested embryos, I still did the testing. So you can't be falsely reassured by having normal PGT tested embryos. That just guides for implant, you know, which embryos are going to be put back when mm-hmm. you are going through the process of IVF. Okay, so right. this does still apply to
I definitely would talk with your REI team about what the lab they use and what their quoted detection rates are for chromosome differences. A lot of times they are higher than something like a first trimester screen or a quad scene. And even for some conditions, maybe higher than an NIPT. But again, because it's still looking at placental information, mm-hmm. following up with an NIPT usually doesn't give you additional information as to whether fetus is actually affected rather than a placenta.
Okay, so is NIPT or maternal, so maternal T21 is another name for it, I think. Still sufficient enough, did not have NT scan or blood serum, only had NIPT and AFP after 15 weeks. So yeah, so most patients, lower risk patients will do NIPT or cell-free DNA screening. There's a number of things that NIPT is called. And then the AFP after 15 weeks. What I was saying earlier is this, in the advanced maternal age population, it is now recommended to do, if you do the NIPT, to do the AFP, obviously, but also add that nuchal translucency measurement in the first trimester as well. So if you're not in advanced maternal age or of other higher risk for anything else, then NIPT plus AFP is perfectly fine.
We still find it helpful to have a nuchal measurement. It's hard. I think a lot of providers don't mm-hmm. always coordinate that, and it's okay if you don't have it. A lot of the things that it looks for, we would have an idea from an anatomy ultrasound at 18 to 22 weeks as well. But a nuchal translucency measurement, it's not super specific, but it casts a wide net for things we may want to consider. Things that may not necessarily be chromosome differences could be things like heart defects or single gene conditions called Noonan syndrome, lymphatic issues, depending, and it all depends on how thick that nuchal translucency is. The size really does matter. And so it just adds additional pieces mm-hmm. of information about chromosome differences, but just also other things that we would want to be on the lookout for. But things like heart defects, structural differences, like we see in some babies with Noonan syndrome or other microdeletion or duplication syndromes, those are things we would also look for on an anatomy scan. So it's okay if you didn't have it done, that's perfectly fine. It's just a matter of things that we now are thinking about now that NIPT is a little more common nowadays and first trimester screening may be kind of going out the wayside.
Yeah, so just to clarify a little bit more about the NIPT plus the NT, I would love if all of the patients that had NIPT got an NT. But the reality is with payers, a lot of them won't pay for both because they're both considered screening tests, right? But if you're over advanced maternal age, a lot of payers will cover it, or they're starting to cover it more because of the recommendations that are coming out. But you can, even if you're low risk and you're not over age 35, if you wanted to add the NT onto the NIPT in the right time frame for it and your payer pays for it, I would do it. Yeah. I don't think there's any harm in not doing it. You just might have to double check and make sure your payer pays for it. Or if you really, really want it and it doesn't, then exactly. you might have to pay out.
Someone just asked a really great question and a point I wanted to hit home earlier and completely forgot. Can serum screening, like first trimester quad screening, be positive just based on age-related risk? Yes, 100%. That's the limit of those serum screens in patients over the age of 35. So usually their cutoff for what's considered a high risk result is what the risk for that condition is at someone who's the age of 35 or older. And so even if you have perfect picture, PAPA, HCG, inhibin, UE3, AFPs, it still may come back high risk above that threshold. It may still reduce your risk from where your age-related risk was, but it still may be above that threshold for age-related risk. And so that is a benefit of NIPT over those types of screens, because NIPT does not take into account your age-related risk in calculating whether it's high risk or low risk until after you have that calculation based on the amount of genetic information in your blood. And we calculate that positive mm-hmm. predictive value or that residual risk afterwards.
Right. So that's a great question. So there's a lot that goes into this, but it shouldn't. I want to have this conversation because I don't want it to be scary. I want it to be a positive thing. I feel like this type of testing is more empowering. I feel like my patients are more empowered and have more information to understand it better when they have it than when they don't. because when they don't, and then I see something, you know, sometimes it's hard to even get past it because they're so upset and preoccupied with it that you, it's hard to even have that conversation. But if they know that they came in with a negative screening, and then I saw these isolated markers, they're much more at ease, if that makes sense. So obviously I'm very pro antenatal screening, based on what I do and what I see in the patient experiences I've had. I don't know that I've ever had a patient regret having the screening. So, you know, I've never had anybody say, I wish I hadn't had it done. You know, it's sometimes it's the other way around, and they wish they had, especially before the NIPT came along, we didn't have that. They really wish they had, and they were out of the window, and they couldn't even get the quad screen anymore. But thankfully, the NIPT, you know, allows us to still screen even at later gestational ages, because sometimes we're not getting them at 18 to 22 weeks. A lot of my patients don't get anatomy at 18 to 22 weeks. They're later in pregnancy than that. So the NIPT is always an option if we do see something. So I am very pro genetic counseling, and I'm very pro antenatal screening. So I'm going to let you go, but
I think just, make the best decisions for you guys. Ask your providers these specific questions. If they cannot answer those specific questions, ask to be referred to a MFM or genetic counselor. We're here, we're able to help talk through these different options, have these in-depth 1 hour conversations with you. Based on what's actually going to be helpful and why you want to have that testing in the first place. So there are lots of resources out there available for you to talk about your own specific risks.
Yeah, I not all general OBGYNs can have these types of conversations because they don't do that every day. They might order the test and that's it. And I don't necessarily fault them for that, but the answer is not to say, oh, you don't need it. Or, you know, you're low risk, so it's okay if you don't want to have it done. That's not always the answer either. You know, if a patient's asking questions and, you know, and you're not comfortable doing this type of counseling, then like Liz said, send them to somebody who will. Send them to somebody who will, because they, as ACOG says, every patient is entitled and should be offered antenatal screening and diagnostic testing despite any risk they have, even if they don't have any risk, they are still entitled to that. So we should be offering that to all of our patients. And if we can't answer the questions for them that they are asking,
exactly. That's why we have specialty. Correct? I mean, that's why I have a job, because all these different tests are coming out nowadays. And it's hard, especially if you're in a general specialty, to keep up with all the specific areas. Just like you would not want me counseling on medications during pregnancies and who should be taking what or what this glucose screen says. You don't want me taking care of that. I'm referring to Dr. Clark. And if Dr. Clark has specific genetic questions that she can't answer, she's referring back to me. So we all work together as part of your care team to best take care of you and your pregnancy. And genetic testing does not mean you're not going to be there for the pregnancy. We're not going to take care of you. It's just an option if you're looking for more information. But it's also well within your rights to decline knowing that.
Yeah. I know. We're both very, very pro screening, but again, I'm not ever going to say something, you have to do this. Yeah. You know, obviously I'm going to be pro testing, but I also respect those individuals. As long as they have the right counseling, they need to have the right counseling. As long as they have the right counseling and then they say, you know what, I don't want it. Fine. But at least I know that I counsel them on the, you know, why it's recommended and what it can do. They absolutely can decline, right, and that's exactly perfectly within their rights.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you so much. This is excellent. Excellent. I'm going to post this and then eventually turn it to a podcast and all the other things I do with my live discussions. This was very needed. And I think we should follow up. If there's anything else you want us to talk about for another session, put it in the comments under this video. But we're definitely going to come back and talk about amnio and CVS for another session. Those are the diagnostics.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Have a great rest of your day. Bye-bye.